Hello and welcome to the Greenwich Podcast. I'm Alex Mitchell. Coming up in this edition, we hear how the internet starts in Greenwich, we investigate what the council are doing to get more people connected to the web, and I'll be talking to urban ecologist Dusty Gedge about the green spaces that he's planning to grow right over your heads. First though, the internet. Now you, dear listener, are almost certainly a regular internet user. You probably have a broadband connection at home, and if this connection breaks down, it's as irritating as not having any hot water. But many people in the borough don't have internet access at home, and we sent James to find out how this problem is being addressed.
I'm standing in the shadow of the new Ravensbourne building on Greenwich Peninsula. Ravensbourne's arrival in Greenwich is expected to give a shot in the arm to the local economy, and the hope is that it'll turn Greenwich into a digital hotspot. But while a lot's been written about the transformative effect its arrival will have on business, there's been less coverage of its effect on the ordinary population. To find out what plans the council has to connect up this vital part of the borough, I went to talk to Councillor Denise Highland, and I started off by asking her a pretty basic question.
Do you have any idea how many people can't get access to the internet who want to get access to the internet?
I would imagine actually there are hundreds of people in the borough who have no access to the internet or can't afford the infrastructure to provide that kind of technology for themselves. You know, we know that the younger generation are very keen on computer games and they're computer literate right from a very early age. But for those people who have no access to the internet in their homes, that's really where you get the digital divide. And where I am in Abbey Wood, most people who come into my surgery, if I ask them for an email address, they don't have one. So it really is a real issue for people. And when you consider that the government are talking about benefits, actually people claiming online for their benefits, wow, there's a long way to go before we're there.
Because, I mean, I think part of the problem is that when people think about broadband provision and getting, you know, super fast broadband in, they think of it as being a business opportunity. And maybe don't think so much about the more social side of things.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I can remember working in community education 20 years ago, and people were excluded from having bank accounts. Now, having your salary now paid into a bank account is just an everyday situation for all of us. I think it is crucial, but it's a way in which we as a borough make sure no one is left out of those opportunities. And whether that's through adult and community learning, through our libraries, through the way we do business, we need to ensure that no one is excluded.
So what is the council doing to help people get online?
Well, Greenwich Council has had up to now UK Online, and that was funded until 2 years ago, and Greenwich Council have actually funded it for the last 2 years. Unfortunately, because we've been cut back £63 million over the next 4 years, sadly, we've had to take the decision to finish that provision at the end of this month.
What is UK Online?
UK Online basically is tuition and mobile internet access where, you know, a rather big Winnebago goes around the town centres, giving people the ability to get online and to have some tuition.
So it seems that the best way, in fact the only way, to get onto the internet if you don't have a computer is to use your local library. I went to Woolwich Library to find out who was using these public access computers.
My name is Abdul Yakut.
So why have you come in today?
I just came today to find some telephone numbers and to check my email.
Uh-huh. You don't have internet access at home?
I've got an internet access at home.
So why did you come into the library? Did you just find yourself in town? Or?
Yeah, I was in the town and then I needed to check my email, so I came to the library.
And so what are you using the internet for in the library today?
Checking my email, checking some social networking websites.
And do you come here a lot to do this?
No, my power adapter broke down, so my home internet is not working.
So this is a crisis visit?
Yeah.
Do you come into the library a lot?
Yes, because right now my laptop is having technical problems. So this is the only place where I can access the internet and I found it quite useful. Except that we only allocated 1 hour, which at times doesn't seem to be adequate, especially if you're doing an online application. they request for so much detail and you cannot complete it within an hour. So you have to save and then come in for another hour. And then at times it's slow and it's not working to at the level you expect it to. So it can be delaying to the work that you want to do.
Can I ask what you're looking at on the internet today?
I was just looking about castles. I'm a writer. I'm just doing some research.
Mm-hmm. And so do you come and use the library often?
Practically every day.
Right. And do you find it's a good provision?
It's a bit slow at times because these computers have been here ages.
Old computers and limited access. It doesn't sound like the equal opportunities that Councillor Highland's aiming for. I put some of these problems to the senior librarian, Jenny Hobart.
It is a very, very popular service and the demand is huge. Mm. We are going to be opening a new Woolwich Library, hoping to open in July, where there will be a lot more internet provision. There's going to be more PCs as well as laptops that people will be able to use. So it's, you know, the demand is there and we're obviously hoping to meet that demand.
Mm. And so at the moment you're sort of winding down the PCs that you have?
Yeah, I mean at the moment we've got 17 PCs that the public can use, but when we get the new PCs over in the new library, we're going to have all the new programmes on. It's going to be a lot more updated service. But at the moment, the PCs are very, very heavily used at the moment, and we know that demand's going to be increased, so we are going to meet it in the library.
Is there anything else that you think you could do in order to make it a bit more easy for people to get access to computers? I mean, making them mobile?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, hence the reason why in the new library we're going to be providing laptops for people to use so they can borrow a laptop and use within the library wherever they want.
So I've just been talking to people downstairs, and the main thing that's coming back is that there isn't really quite enough time for them to do, for instance, online job applications. Mm-hmm. And so they'd like it to be like up to 2 hours. What do you think about that?
Well, what we try and do, because of the huge demand at Woolwich, we tend to let people have anything for 15 minutes up to an hour. If people are typing a CV and they need more time, if there's no PCs booked, we can give them extra time. But because of the huge demand at Woolwich, we've had to say up from 15 minutes up to an hour a day. Hopefully when the new Woolwich Library opens this year, we're thinking it's going to be open in July, there'll be more PCs and we obviously will review that, and it could be that we will be letting the borrowers have more time on the PCs, but we just wanted to make it fairer for everyone.
The computers in Woolwich Library are clearly oversubscribed and a lot seems to hinge on the new centre when it opens. Most of the people I talked to were using the library as a backup service because their computers had broken down. In fact, it seemed to me that it would be a good idea for the council to run a computer clinic at the library, which would stop taxpayers being ripped off by some of the high street computer stores. But there didn't seem to be much of a push to get people who didn't use computers hooked up. I put this point to Denise Highland.
It's all very well kind of giving provision for internet access in libraries and things like that. Is part of the problem the fact that some people don't want to get onto the internet? And would you do anything in order to encourage people to become more digital?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we've managed to do is work with Ravensbourne to develop a digital skills centre, which means that we run short vocational courses for Greenwich residents through our adult and community learning programme. So basically, it hopefully will address the challenge of the digital divide and demonstrates commitment in extending opportunities right across the community.
There are other schemes planned to get the residents of Greenwich online. For instance, the council is starting a pilot scheme to get 4G technology into the area, and this will provide Wi-Fi hotspots around the borough. But I thought it would be a good idea to see, finally, how personally engaged with the internet Councillor Highland was.
What are your top 5 sites that you go to all the time?
Oh dear, can you pause that?
Time to consult the communications officer.
Because you said five.
Well, okay, top sites.
Okay, top sites. All right, here we go. Okay, my top sites are iPlayer. I go on my own mail website if I'm travelling around. I obviously go on the Greenwich Council website and get up to date with what information is being given to the public and what the public think about our services and so on. And lastly, I'm trying to sell my car. So So I'm shopping about to see what kind of price I might get for my car when I sell my little MX5. No, I'm joking. So.
And I'm sure the Greenwich podcast site will be up there very soon.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Councillor Denise Hyland ending that report from James Crawford. And there'll be more from James later on in the show. Now, here in Greenwich, we're lucky enough to live in a particularly green part of London. But there's a growing school of thought that says that we're only using a fraction of the space available to us to grow plants. They are the advocates of green roofs, and one of their most high-profile members is local boy Dusty Gedge. He invited me up onto one of the roofs he's planted to tell me about his plans to make Greenwich a little more like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. We're standing here on a pretty windswept Laban Centre roof down by the creek in Deptford on the Greenwich border. It's a beautiful sunny day and the roof's looking a little brown, but there are signs of life and it's a beautiful sight really. We're here with Dusty Gedge, who's a global green roof campaigner. He's the man to go to if you want to know why you should be putting something on your roof that grows, and he's here to just tell us why it's so important.
Well, there's lots of reasons. So, you know, when I talk about these things, I'll talk about them. What I call the micro and the macro. Certainly on the macro, this is London as a city. It's predicted we're going to get hotter summers, mm-hmm. which we are getting. Everybody loves it, but actually it's a problem. Mm. Last week of June 2009, we had a health alert 2, sick, the old, the vulnerable, asthmatic,
right.
Don't go out.
Yeah.
The GLA, predict death by 2020
really?
From urban heat island effect.
And urban heat island effect is basically just because it's surrounded, we've got so much concrete and built-up areas, it gets hotter here than it does in the country.
Yeah. So what happens with the urban heat island effect, it's very, very hot in the day, then it's very, very hot at night.
Right.
And then it's hotter the next day and it keeps growing. Yeah.
Oh,
so somewhere like Chicago has about, I think, 600 deaths which were related to urban heat island effect every year. I mean, it's the old, the vulnerable, the sick, you know. And so it's going to be an increasing problem. So
because buildings act like storage heaters in a sense.
Well, the
roads at night, they sort of release
black
it.
And they release it. And
yeah.
It's just basically all that sunlight is being stored
okay.
in the black. And then when the sun goes away,
yeah.
that's dissipated back into the atmosphere and makes okay. the nights hot. And we all know if you live in London, when we've had a really, really hot day
yeah.
and there's no wind, actually the
Stifling.
Nights are really unbearable.
Yeah. So
you know, if you live in social housing,
green roofs help that, then?
Well, the government's accepted we need an increase of 10% green space in our cities by 2020. By 2020 to combat climate change. Well, in most of central London, you will not be able to plant trees or make parks.
It's just not room.
Yeah, 32. Well, I think it's 56% of the land area of the city of London, sorry, of central London, is roofs.
Right.
56% of it, right? And then you say 20% of it is roads.
Can't do that on roads.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're saying, well, that's the only place we can do that is on buildings.
Right.
So we need to be putting vegetation and soil on buildings to help us combat the urban heat island effect.
Yeah.
The other thing that's been predicted for cities in the UK and across the world is not only increased urban heat island effect, is an increase in short summer storms, maybe 2-minute storms, but the volume of water that comes down causes flash floods. So again, 2009, I just remember this one, but so July, first week, we had 6 intense summer rainstorms and 17 tube stations flooded. Yeah. Because we have a lot of hard surface and a lot of roofs, when it rains, most of the rain is falling on roofs.
Yeah.
And on a roof, that water will be off the roof within about 30 seconds. Yeah. And then you've got all the roads, and then all that rain builds up, and the drains can't cope. And sometimes it gets really bad, 2005, and they have to release raw sewage into the Thames.
Yeah.
It's terrible, but actually they have to.
And the fish die.
And the fish die. And there's lots of problems there, yeah? So the idea is if you put sort of 4 inches, 100 mil of soil on a roof, and it's not topsoil, it's rubble, you know?
Yeah.
When it rains, in most events, no water will leave the roofs, yeah?
Right.
Now you look at this, you go, well, that's just one little roof. But if the whole of the central activity zone, which is central London,
yeah.
was covered in green,
sure.
that's all that rain being stored.
Yeah.
And that's why we have a policy in London.
So how does Greenwich Borough measure up to the green roof kind of expansion plans that you want to do?
Well, there are a lot of green roofs going up in the Greenwich side of Deptford Creek. These were planned in 1999, so that's the Greenwich millennium where the ocean line is going. It's Greenwich Reach, that's called.
Yeah.
Most of that will be green roofs. We managed to make that happen in 1999. And this is, I can't remember what it is, Greenwich Millennium or something. This is the first part. That's in Lewisham, that is.
Right.
And this bit's in Greenwich.
Yeah.
And this will have green roofs on it. And so will when they develop all that up. Oh, and then there's Pope and Borthwick, which is right on the river.
Yeah.
And it's the last two buildings on the Thames, on the east side of Greenwich. They will have green roofs on them. And then you've got Convoy's Wharf, which is Lewisham. So there are quite a few green roofs going up in London. But the main area is Greenwich Peninsula.
Yeah.
The first two, there's that funky building by the dome, by the O2.
Oh, yeah, I know.
That's got a green roof
on
it. And, you know, to be fair to Lendlease, who are the main developer, who I know, working with the Environment Agency and the borough, They're conditioned, which means they have to put up 40% of the building footprint as green roofs.
Right.
But it actually is in their document, to be fair to them. It says they have 100% aspiration,
okay,
but it's all going to come down to economics. And that's a big bill. That won't be complete until 2025. Yeah, it's very, very positive.
Sounds like everyone's going in the right direction. What if you just want to do it yourself at home?
Well, if you want to do it yourself, you can go out and you can buy these kits. But again, generally, the market is trying to sell you these thin kits.
Right,
yeah?
Okay.
So, again, what I did, you know, I just had a book published by Timber Press with Nigel Dunnett, who won the silver at Chelsea, and then my other colleague was part of that with our container, John Little. We also wrote an e-guide, John and I, because we were getting about 150 emails a week. People saying, how do I build my own green roof?
Yeah.
So we wrote this guide, and it's an e-guide. You download it. It costs £11.
Yeah.
And you can do a shed. It explains how you have to beef up the shed, how you do that. And how you can hold the saws on the shed.
And can I get everything I want for my shed roof from B&Q or any old, you know,
well, no, you,
shop? Or do I
no,
need
what
specialist
you, the, in the guide, there's a list of suppliers.
Okay.
And actually, it's often quite cheap to sort of almost buy it sort of piecemeal.
So roundabout price, just off the top of your head, just because I want to get an idea, if I did my shed, which is a kind of, you know, 4 by 8, let's say.
Well, I'll do 3 metres by 3 metres.
Okay.
It's easier for me.
How much
I'm metric.
Would it cost me? Yeah.
It's normally about £20 to £35 a square metre commercial.
Okay, yeah.
So that's what that is. But I would budget on 50.
Yeah.
And then if you come in under 5 times 6 is 30, 350 quid. If you come under that.
It's not kind of something you just do on a whim,
no.
Like you might, you know, put up a hanging basket,
no,
you know.
No.
Is it really worth us all doing that?
Well, I mean, on the bigger scale, I mean, like, if you've got, you know, let's say there's, I don't know, there's probably about 6 million people. There's probably about 3 million sheds of 6 square metres. Well, that's quite a lot of land area, isn't it? And that could add up. But I think I always make a difference between the domestic and the global, yeah?
Yeah.
They will make some contribution. If you've got a whole of a street which has got loads of extensions all having those green roofs, that's going to make some contribution
sure.
to water.
Okay.
Not so much about the urban heat effect. It's certainly going to keep your buildings cooler in the summertime. But really, the way most people contact you is they said, I just would like to look out on something nice.
Yeah.
I bring a friend of mine, he's been in the press a lot. He's an architect. He built his up in Newington Green. And it's surrounded by houses, and the whole building is covered in green roofs. And I designed them, and it's called The Mews. You go on Living Roofs, you see the case study. Well, he dined out for a summer from every resident surrounding him, saying, like, thanks for making my life so good.
Sure.
And so I think we sometimes undervalue the sheer pleasure you can get out of something.
Finally, we're off down a small side street to Enderby's Wharf to hear about one of Greenwich's oldest and most internationally significant companies. Alcatel-Lucent is a high-tech cable company with a long history in the business, perhaps the longest history in the world. James went along to find out more.
In August last year, you might have seen a large blue and white boat travelling up the Thames. This was the Ile de Bréhat, which is a cable-laying ship owned by Alcatel-Lucent, and it was part of a day celebrating a Queen's Award for Industry that the company won. There's been a cable company at Enderby's Wharf for over 150 years, since cables were first invented, according to long-term employee and manager Neville Hazel.
The first telegraph cables made here were back in the 1850s, and the reason they were made here is because it was essentially a whaling operation run by Captain Enderby, who of course features in Moby Dick.
Does he? Hasn't he?
Oh yes, yeah. And any whaling ship needed ropes, so it was a rope factory. And that meant you had nice long runs. So when people came up with the idea of telegraph cables, you had the sort of facility that could be adapted from making rope to making telegraph cables.
Because this is something I didn't understand, that that telegraph cables are really just kind of ropes made with metal, is that right?
Yeah, a little bit more than that. You have to provide a little bit of insulation in there, so the electrical conductor is isolated from the water in which you're in. But yeah, a lot of the principles and the equipment for handling it on the ships would have been the same, and they would have been slowly adapted over the years to be that little bit different for handling a cable.
Initially, the cables made here were run between England and the continent, and between the continent's various countries. It wasn't long before ambitious cable companies started looking west to the other side of the Atlantic. Tom Standage is a Greenwich resident and author of the book The Victorian Internet.
So this is a picture on my wall, and it's an engraving that's been hand-coloured of the HMS Agamemnon, 91 guns, and it says underneath, shipping the English portion of the Atlantic submarine cable at East Greenwich. And it's clearly, you've got the ship in the middle, the hero of the picture, and various small boats going to and fro from the shore. But you can also see this cable being going along a series of sort of wheels, I suppose, on floating pontoons that's been taken onto the ship. And you can see that the whole scene is set in Greenwich because you've got the Naval College over here in the background. And so this is the beginning of this whole industry appearing in East Greenwich, which is making submarine cables. The rather Heath Robinson approach they took was that they sailed out to from the west of Ireland to the middle of the Atlantic. They spliced the two ends of the cable together, and then the ships sail off in the opposite direction. So USS Niagara heads off to America, Agamemnon heads back to Ireland. The cable broke a couple of times, and they kept having to go back to the rendezvous point and start again. And they could tell whether the cable was still working because they could then send ship-to-ship messages, you know, from each end of the cable. And eventually they managed to get this to work. For a few days, it was possible to send messages from Europe to America. And there was an absolute amazing sort of outbreak of hysteria when this happened. You know, people said it was going to undo the independence of the United States. It was going to lead to world peace. You know, there were torchlit processions in New York. People went absolutely out of their minds. And people think that internet mania was bad, you know, at the end of the 1990s. It was absolutely nothing like telegraph mania was in the 1850s.
In my naive way, I always thought there was one cable between here and the States and all the messages passed along it. Not so, according to Neville Hazel.
In fact, apparently around 1900, Reuters alone had around 15 cables across the Atlantic because it was the only way they could get their capacity for their telegrams. And at the time, apparently, it was around $1,000 a word. So you can imagine you're on your mobile phone texting away and it's 140 characters, let's call that 10 words, $10,000 bill for your tweet, yeah? Guess how much it costs now, tenths of a cent. So you can see how the evolution in technology has just brought the cost down and down and down and put it at everybody's fingertips. It's just been an amazing evolution.
Nowadays, instead of telegraph cables, the company makes high-tech fibre optic cables.
From around 93 onwards, it went to optical amplifier technology, where essentially the fibre became a light pipe. And it was used in a way that's sort of a bit like DAB radio. It's a digital radio type technique with lots and lots of channels packed into the fibre on different wavelengths. And essentially, the technology advances now very much in the terminal equipment, making best use of that pipe that exists between the two points of presence in the different countries.
Laying these cables around the world can mean the company gets into some pretty tight places. This year alone has seen war in Libya, earthquakes and nuclear leaks in Japan, and trouble in Nigeria, all of which has had an effect on how Alcatel-Lucent does its job, according to Norma Spruce, head of marketing communications.
I wouldn't say we've been directly involved, but we have been impacted by troubles in various parts of the world. Wherever we're laying cables, we go into countries all over the world. And yes, a lot of our cable projects at the moment have been in areas where there have been a few problems, because mainly our systems are in Africa and the Middle East at the moment.
I understand that the piracy problem around Africa has had a bit of an impact on you.
Again, if we are sending a ship out to lay a cable in an area where there is piracy, we have to take all the appropriate precautions to ensure the safety of the vessel and the people on board the vessel. And as such, if we are laying in areas where there is a significant risk of piracy, we will look for assistance from our appropriate sort of governments to provide adequate protection for the vessel and the crew.
What sort of assistance have you had in the past?
In the past, when we've been laying in certain waters in African regions, we've actually had military personnel on board the ship to guard the safety of our ships.
The threat of piracy, nuclear fallout, and the risk of being caught up in a war are not, however, the worst threats that the crews come up against, according to one of the company's captains who I met on a tour of the factory.
What are the biggest problems that you face as a captain?
Bad food. There are so many different kind of problems. And the thing is, we have to deal with it. So the worst would be to lose the ship or the crew. The thing is, apart from that, there is no bigger problem.
Right.
I mean,
pirates?
This is a concern. It becomes a problem when they attack you, which is a little bit different. The thing is trying to avoid them or to take the precautions not to have them on board. That's what we did on Somalia.
Alcatel-Lucent employs over 200 people and is one of the top manufacturing companies within the M25. But how important is it for them to be based in Greenwich?
Personally, myself, well, this is my home. I think so. That's for me. For the company, it's. Gives us great flexibility on our workforce in the sense that the number of staff we need is very dependent on the scale of the projects we take on board. It can the number of production hours that we're trying to deploy in a given month can vary by a factor of 10 from one month to another month, you know, a year later. So we can't manage all our operation with permanent staff, and London has a great pool of talented people that we can tap into when we need to.
And if the world ever decides it has enough cable, Alcatel-Lucent have other tricks up their sleeve. So I understand that when it actually stopped manufacturing cable, there were some sort of redundant areas that were put to interesting use.
Yes, here at Greenwich, at one point we had a lot of cable tanks when we used to make cable, because the cable is stored in very large tanks. We also have a spring here on site, a natural spring. So the inventiveness of our staff at Greenwich created a trout farm at one point here on the site at Greenwich, which unfortunately is no longer here.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for at the moment. If you want to find out more about any of the stories in this edition, there are lots of links on the webpage, greenwichpodcast.com. We'll be back soon with more tales from around Greenwich. Until then, goodbye.